Good morning, everyone.
They are worthy of.
I will call the meeting of the Civil and Data Practices Committee to order. One thing that I forgot to mention, well, I'll wait till all the members get here, and then I'll make the announcement about if you're presenting bill for the first time as a freshman that you have to bring treats.
Yeah.
I'll wait for all the freshmen to get here and re-announce that.
Did we break that rule already this year, Madam Chair?
No, we haven't had any freshmen present a bill.
Okay.
So I wanted to make sure I mentioned that. So, oh, here comes another freshman.
Excellent.
She'll know. We'll make sure she knows your lesson.
Representative Omar, I was just saying that I forgot to make an announcement the first day that we met, and that is that if you are a freshman and you have a bill that you're presenting in our committee for the first time, it is your responsibility to bring treats for the entire group. And we're easy to please. All right. The first order of business would be to approve the minutes of January 10th. Do Representative Lucero, would you like to move those minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
The minutes have been moved. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. Today we're going to be hearing three, as we kindly refer to them as bar bills, and not the kind where you get booze. So thank you for laughing.
You're welcome.
Representative Smith has three bills he's going to be presenting today. The first one is House File 22. Representative Smith, would you like to move that bill?
So moved, Madam Chair.
And this bill will be is recommended to be re-referred to the Agricultural Policy Committee, and we'll find out more why. Representative Smith, go ahead and go ahead with your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Good morning. This bill, House File 22, eliminates an unnecessary reporting requirement for agricultural land held in revocable trusts. Many farmers are unaware of this requirement, and their failure to comply can result in, or does result in, a criminal penalty. And I have Ms. Jennifer Lammers to discuss some more technical elements of the bill this morning, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Ms. Lammers, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. My name is Jennifer Lammers. I'm an attorney at Briggs & Morgan, which is a law firm, and I specialize in estate planning and administration. So the bill today has to do with the Corporate Farm Act, and I've testified in front of this committee before on the Corporate Farm Act. And the purpose of the Corporate Farm Act is to make sure that corporate entities such as LLCs, partnerships, and corporations are not contaminating land. So if a corporation, an LLC, or a partnership owns farmland and it's in one of those entities, the Department of Agriculture monitors that to make sure that the land continues to be contamination-free because of limited liability status. They don't want people coming in and contaminating the land and then walking away from it, and the taxpayers are stuck cleaning up land. Revocable trusts are not a limited liability entity. They have no limited liability protection. If a farmer contaminates the land, he has to pay or she has to pay for cleanup. There's no way that they can just walk away from that. So the fact that the revocable trusts have to report under the Corporate Farm Act was a bit of a misnomer, and it has caused a great amount of distress and unnecessary paperwork for farmers having to do this, especially with the criminal penalty. And we've received a lot of feedback asking that this requirement be taken off the bill because it serves absolutely no purpose other than aggravating farmers and creating paperwork and unnecessary expense to have sometimes a lawyer to have to do that for them. So that's why we're here today. So we really appreciate the honor and privilege to be able to get this cleaned up for a lot of farmers.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have no concern with the proposal. Does it have any retroactivity issues, or is there any cases pending where someone's not been compliant that we are currently interfering in?
Thanks, Madam Chair. We have not asked that there be retroactivity.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this might be for the testifier.
Representative Smith. So I'm just trying to understand, wrap my head around this. So if an individual owns the farm and the property and they put it in a revocable trust and it's later found that there was large contamination on the site, is the individual still holding a responsibility for some of that cleanup, or does it fall on the trust, and since there's a revocable trust here now, does that alleviate their responsibility?
Ms. Lammers?
Madam Chair. So your question is, in the event that individual places agricultural land subject to this reporting inside a revocable trust, is the individual exempt from contamination liability? Yeah, and no.
Any further questions? Seeing none, Representative Smith renews his motion that House File 22 is, is there any public testimony for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Smith renews his motion that House File 22 be recommended to be re-referred to the Agricultural Policy Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. House File 22 is on its way. Thank you, Ms. Lammers, for being here. Next up is House File 13. Representative Smith, would you like to move your bill? It looks like it's headed to the General Register.
Yes, so moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, House File 13 is before us. Representative Smith, do you have an amendment, I believe?
I do, Madam Chair. Members, Amendment A2, this is a technical amendment that gets the bill in the shape that I prefer. I ask for your support.
Thank you. Any discussion on the A2? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A2 onto House File 13, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. House File 13 has been amended with the A2. Representative Smith, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House File 13, the Nonprofit Corporate Act, this bill revises Chapter 317A and makes it better aligned with the Business Corporation Act, Chapter 302A. This bill makes clarifying and modernizing changes. The overall intent is to make 317A more clear and prevent unintended consequences. Having an outdated 317A subjects nonprofit officers and directors to unnecessary risks and legal costs. And I have Ms. Kim Lowe here to add some technical testimony, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Lowe. Go ahead and state your name for the tape and continue on.
My name is Kimberly Lowe, and I'm a lawyer in Minneapolis.
Go ahead with your testimony,
perfect,
please.
Thank you. As Representative Smith said, what we're working on here with these changes to 317A is an effort to make sure that our nonprofit corporation statute functions similarly to our for-profit corporation statutes, only where they should function similarly. We understand at the bar, the legal counsel, we understand that nonprofits and for-profits are not the same, but there's many benefits to having our statutes look similar because the lawyers that work with them tend to be the same lawyers. So the desire to harmonize and modernize is really to make sure that they stay aligned so that the lawyers that work with them don't have these unintended consequences because the language starts to get a little bit differing as we go through the process over the years. So most of the changes that are being proposed really are about that alignment concept. Another part of the changes that we're recommending or asking for is that we eliminate some errors that have crept up over time with respect to how we deal or we identify members of nonprofit organizations and who has voting rights. Those are really technical cleanups. One thing that we are, that the bill is asking for is that we allow for the ability of our nonprofit members of our board of directors to use electronic voting methods. Many of our nonprofit directors do this anyway. It's the modern world, and that's the way people interact when they're on boards of directors, but our statute doesn't allow for that. So that change to allow for that sort of modern way that people generally serve on boards is really what we're recommending with one of these changes in 317A.011. We're also looking at the change to allow nonprofit corporations that have subsidiaries. Oftentimes when a nonprofit corporation owns a piece of real estate or has some sort of other activity that's related to what it's doing, for legal purposes, it will place that activity into what we call a subsidiary. One of the requests or one of the elements of this this amendment or this bill is to allow for a simple mechanism by which that subsidiary can be merged up right into that nonprofit. Right now, we don't have that. This has nothing to do with the taxability, nothing to do with the nonprofit statute, status of the entities. It really just has to do with making it easy for this to be corrected and taken care of for these nonprofits. Otherwise, they're spending a lot of money on legal fees and a lot of money on administrative burdens that don't need to be there. So if we have our statute allow for it, it really makes it a much more easier method for our nonprofits to be able to function a little easier. We're also recommending or looking at adding a conversion statute or conversion method to our nonprofit statute. And what this allows is it allows nonprofits from other states to convert into nonprofits in the state of Minnesota and vice versa. So it does allow a mechanism, we don't have this now, but allows a mechanism for nonprofits that say maybe in another state but want to move their headquarters here to Minnesota to do that easily. Right now, for that to happen, it takes a great deal of legal fees and mechanisms. And so that the conversion statute, the conversion elements that we're recommending or that are included in this bill are really meant to ease that process. All of those conversion mechanisms align with what the IRS allows for tax-exempt nonprofits to do. And the Attorney General and the Bar work together to make sure that those conversion statutes also keep in place the current oversight that the Attorney General has.
Thank you. I was amazed in reading through that this was all new language. I was astonished that there wasn't really anything in statute already addressing these things. I do have one question. I'll get to you, Representative Hillstrom. Does the corporate world, the private sector, they allow electronic signatures from their board members as well? Ms. Lowe?
Madam Secretary, the corporate world is, I also sit on the committee that drafts the for-profit statute as well. It happens in the corporate world. We're catching up, but we have electronic communication. We have these other elements that are happening in the corporate world. We haven't amended 302A yet to connect these dots. But it is something that we know is coming because that's how our boards of directors operate. They have a board meeting by email and say, can everyone vote? And they say, yes, by email. And right now, that's what people are doing, and our statutes haven't quite caught up to that.
Representative Smith,
Madam Chair,
comment?
We'll be back next week with that bill.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Smith, or to your testifier, there are some places in statute, for example, health agencies, our healthcare HMOs, our nonprofit status. I mean, there are some places in statute where we require certain meetings to be more public. What does these... Does these changes have any impact on those kinds of entities? And is there any concern about oversight with these changes based on, again, we've been spending hours and hours and hours talking about healthcare entities, and they are nonprofit in this state. I'm curious about this, the impact of this on those.
Ms. Lowe, Madam Secretary. There is no intent, this language in no way intends to override the public meeting rules that I think you're referring to. To the extent a nonprofit corporation is subject to public meeting rules, this has nothing to do with that. They override those rules with respect to how meetings need to be conducted by nonprofit, regardless of the type, if you're in a public, any type of nonprofit organization that is subject to the public meeting rules still have to comply with those rules. And this is not meant to override that in any way.
Any other member questions for this testifier on this bill? Is there anyone in the public that would like to come and testify for or against House File 20 or 13? Seeing no one, Representative Smith renews his motion that House File 13, as amended, be passed and re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. House File 13 passes. Members, the next bill is House File 46. Representative Smith, would you like to move House File 46, that it be recommended to be re-referred to Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance?
Madam Chair, so moved.
The bill is before us, House File 46. Representative Smith, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House File 46, which is a real property technical bill, this bill conforms statutes to existing practices and eliminates obsolete, inefficient, and unproductive recording practices. It also provides some necessary clarity for electronic recording. And there's going to be a couple testifiers. The first, I would like to ask Mr. Kevin Dunleavy to offer some technical insight.
Very good. Mr. Dunleavy, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and go on with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kevin Dunleavy, and I am the co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association. Section 1 of the bill and Section 2 in combination, they address contracts for deed. Contracts for deed are frequently used for seller financing. Mom and Pa sell the farm at the kitchen table on a contract for deed. And when the original contract for deed is recorded, a certificate of real estate value is also filed at the same time. And that's used for by the Department of Revenue and local assessors to look at comparable values for real estate, and also to make sure that the people that are selling report the gain on their income taxes. Our view is that that's not necessary because when the deed is recorded to pay off the contractor deed, because there's already been one filed and the data is already obsolete 5 years later, the comparable sales data isn't that important. We are meeting with the Department of Revenue this afternoon, and it was our impression from speaking with the Department of Revenue a few years ago that they were okay with this. And we'll find out, I guess, today if they have some concerns, and we'll try to address them. Then we're also speaking with the Minnesota Association of County Recorders regarding any concerns that they might have regarding this. Section 3 of the bill is about electronic recording, and electronic recording is becoming more and more important in Minnesota. And the specific issue that this is intended to address is if you record a document electronically, you can't then print out that document and re-record it. And sometimes you need to re-record documents if there's property in two counties, or if part of it's abstract and part of it's torrent. So this would allow you to record the electronic document, print it out, and then re-record it elsewhere where it needs to be recorded. Section 4, okay, the rest of this is the TORNs. The TORNs amendments. And okay, so what's the TORNs? Okay, Sir Richard Robert Torrens invented the TORN system in the 1800s. He worked in the ship's registry office in Australia. And ship's registries are like certificates of title for cars. So you have one piece of paper that says, here's who owns it, here's what the liens are. Real estate, on the other hand, you have to go dig back into all the deeds and mortgages back to the time of statehood to figure out who owns the property. And that's cumbersome and expensive. And so his idea was, why don't we use something like a certificate of title for real estate? And so that's the TORN system today. About 25 states in the U.S. adopted it, and there's probably half a dozen states, including Minnesota, that have a significant percentage of real estate that's TORNs. In Minnesota, Hennepin, Ramsey are about 50% TORNs. St. Louis is probably maybe 40%, and the rest of the state is less than that. Most of the counties have some TORNs property, but the older urban areas tend to have the most TORNs property. Most of the English-speaking world is TORNs. Canada, Great Britain, Australia, India are all TORNs, and most of the former communist countries are TORNs because their title records got destroyed during the communist era, so they needed something to start with, and so they chose TORNs to have a certificate of title for the real estate. Okay, so that's what TORNs is. As far as these amendments, most of them deal with getting rid of obsolete practices that are no longer used and conforming the statutes to what the existing practice is. Some of it's getting rid of obsolete stuff that it's not used anymore, it doesn't work anymore, and then some of it is intended to make the system work better, to make it more user-friendly for people that have to record or that own TORN's property. Okay. I don't know. How much detail should I get?
Representative Howe, did you have a question to this, to what was being spoken of?
Well, and I don't know how far they're going to go with this, but my question, we're having a, Madam Chair, in the jurisdiction where I work, we're having a real problem with contract for deed properties. What they're doing is the owner is placing it or supposedly selling it on a contract for deed to circumvent the rental registration and the rental process. So they have the person, instead of having to go through the rental process and meeting all the rental requirements, they sell it on a contract for deed with no intention of actually transferring the property, but it's a way that they can get the people in there and they don't have to meet all the rental requirements because now they own it.
So
I want to know how this is going to affect that process. Will it tighten that, or will it have no effect, which I think is a concern of mine?
Mr. Dunleavy?
Madam Chair, Representative, this does not, there's no intent to address that. That's a fraud situation, and it's a local, the local landlord-tenant. And I've heard of those cases. I think there was an article in the newspaper not long ago about some of them in St. Cloud. And I don't like fraud, but this doesn't address that. It's not intended to.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are all contract for deeds required to be registered? And is there a requirement for it to have some transfer of monies to make that happen?
Mr. Dunleavy.
Madam Chair, Representative, there is no specific requirement about like how much of a down payment there has to be on a contract for deed, or how much money has to transfer. That's between the parties. It's based on the contract. But there is a statute that requires recording. And that was passed a few years ago, and I think the public policy reason was because local government wanted to know who owned the property, and so they wanted these documents recorded. And that is a statute. It's generally in the interest of the vendee, the purchaser, to record the contract for deed because it protects their interest. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the reason for the recording requirement.
Mr. Dunleavy, what's the consequence for not filing a contract for not filing it?
Madam Chair, I'd have to look at the statute. I don't know if there's a fine. There might be a civil penalty, but I don't remember what it is.
Right, because I've heard of instances where that, and it wasn't in the state of Minnesota, it was a different state when I lived in Iowa, but if someone forgets to file that, and then the person that is buying that piece of property on the contract for deed decides to sell it again on contract for deed, and the first one wasn't filed, then you got a real problem on your hands. So, any other questions? If not, Mr. Dunleavy, go ahead with your testimony if you wanted to finish up with the bill.
Okay. Just to summarize all the Torrens amendments, for example, section six is to conform this Torrens Act to existing practice. The Torrens Act says there's 90 days to appeal. Well, the rules of civil procedure say 60 days. So rather than having a conflict in the statute and the rule, we're making the statute the same as the rule. So it's 60 days. You can request a reissue certificate of title. So let's say you have a certificate of title and there's a bunch of documents entered on it, like satisfied mortgages and things like that. You can request an exchange certificate for a minimal fee, and then they drop all the basically the garbage from this certificate of title. Eight is a grammatical correction. Nine is there are several bills that deal, several sections of the bill deal with this, but when you have Torrens property, if you have a boundary line issue, you have to go to Torrens Court, the examiner titles, to deal with that. And there's a problem if some of the property is not Torrens, then you have to go to district court for that. So the purpose here is to get all of those boundary line issues into Torrens Court so you don't have to go to court twice to clean up the title of a boundary. And This, my partner does a lot of underlying issues. He's probably got half a dozen going at any time. So there is a fair amount of boundary line litigation in Minnesota. 10 is directives, examiner's directives. There's two ways to deal with problems with Torrance property. One is a petition, which is a court file, and it's fairly expensive in terms of attorney's fees. And the other one is an examiner's directive, where you can write a letter to the examiner titles, and if they think you're right, they'll fix it. And that's much less expensive for the property owner. So we're, one of our objectives over the years has been to try to give the examiner of titles more discretion to fix the minor problems, and that's what 10 does. You can get rid of easements and other interests that have terminated by their own terms, so you don't have to bring a petition to do that. 11, that's conforming existing practice, the statute to existing practice. The normal court filing fee has always applied to Torrance proceedings, so this just makes it so that the statute says the same thing. 12 is you could get a condition of register for $50. It was basically the same as a certified copy, so everybody would just get a certified copy and save $40. So we're getting rid of the reference to the conditions of register. That was back when it was paper. Now it's mostly electronic, so it's kind of obsolete to have conditions of register. Okay, 13. You don't have to say what the market value of the property is. It used to be when you registered property, there would be a fee that was contributed to the state assurance fund based on the value of the property, and now it's just a part of the every recording fee, so it's not based on value anymore, so it's obsolete. 14 is dealing with the appeals for conditions of register, which is a type of Torrance certificate. 15 is, again, changing the appeal period from 90 to 60. 16 is the exchange certificate that I talked to you about. It can be the attorney or the title company that requests them now. It doesn't have to just be the owner. 17 is a grammatical error. 18 is more examiner's directives about easements. Some of these things are twice because there's two chapters, 508 and 508A, that are almost exactly the same, and so a lot of the stuff has to be done twice. We're going to try to fix that at some point. 19 is, again, the condition of register, and 20 is also the boundary line issue that I already mentioned. That's all I have.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Dunleavy? Representative Powell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I've got concerned with the changes of the fees. I got changes with going from 90 to 60. Why do we want to limit the amount of time that you've got the availability to appeal? Because there's sometimes when you're looking at land processes, it takes you a while to figure out exactly what's going on. And if you're a registered landowner next to this piece of property, it's your opportunity to do just that piece. And if you're the I think 90 days is pretty standard, is it not, for most of these appeal processes?
Mr. Dunleavy.
Madam Chair, Representative, the standard appeal is now 60 days, and so the reason that we're changing it to 60 is not because we want to push people along. We don't want somebody to wait till 70 days, make an appeal, and then have the Court of Appeals reject it because it wasn't within 60 days. So we're trying to eliminate a potential problem. I haven't done an appeal on a Torrance proceeding, but they do happen.
Representative Powell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What about the change in on number 12, the changing from 50 to 10? Or section 12, standard documents?
Mr. Dunleavy.
Madam Chair, Representative, this is the conditions of register that was used when these were kept on paper. There used to be these big books that were this big, and they were very heavy. But now it's all electronic, and so you'd get a certified copy, and it'd have, like, ribbons and wax seals and stuff like that on it. And nobody does it anymore, so we just get certified copies of the electronic certificate now.
So,
Representative Howell.
Madam Chair, who collected the $50?
Mr. Dunleavy.
Madam Chair, I believe that the fee is collected by the county, by the Registrar of Titles, which is a local government official, and then the statutes talk about where that money goes. Most of it goes to the local government.
Representative Howe.
Well, there's my concern, Madam Chair, is that now, you know, I don't see anybody from local government, and I know it's not a big amount, but I'd have to believe the staff that's working there is, it would be a cost to the local government, and that would be a part of my concern, but I don't see anybody here representing them. But have they been, has this been okayed by them?
Mr. Dunleavy.
Madam Chair, Representative, there is a person here from the Minnesota Association of County Officers. That's the trade association for the county recorders and the registrar of titles, and they're okay with this, and I believe she'll testify.
Well, that's fine.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Dunleavy. I believe we have Paul Cummings from the Department of Revenue. Good morning and welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I did leave a message for Representative Smith yesterday, and I'm sorry we haven't reached. For the purposes of the Department of Revenue, Section 2 of this bill eliminates the requirement to file a certificate of real estate value when a contract for deed is fulfilled, as long as there are proper documentation references to the original recorded contract. Madam Chair, while this is administrable for the department, we know that the Bar Association, county recorders, county auditors, and the Department of Revenue do have ideas to help change and improve the electronic certificate of real estate value system, and there may be some concerns from some of our customers while the Department of Revenue may find it administrable. We strive to provide the services that are of high quality and meet the needs of our customers. We are going to be convening a group this afternoon. We had a long-standing meeting. It happened to be this afternoon to talk about ECRV and meeting the needs. So the Bar Association will be there, and county recorders will be there, and others. So if further changes are thought about or agreed upon within that smaller group, we thank you, Madam Chair, and this committee and the legislature for your continued openness on the recording of electronics.
Mr. Cummings, what are you seeing as the harm to your customers of making this change?
Madam Chair, I would defer to those people in order to talk about what the harm would be. I know that they are trying to, they have a responsibility to collect deed tax. There are many times in which trying to find out the value of what's going on is very important to trying to record those deeds and then to collect deed tax. But I will admit, Madam Chair, that I am not an expert about those. I do know that the Department of Revenue, however, does not have a concern at this time. But we are trying to, I think we are also trying to manage multiple constituencies that have lots of ideas, and we're hopeful that we will be able to come back with something that meets the needs of all of our customers.
Very well. Thank you. Any questions for this testifier? Representative O'Neill.
It's actually more for you, Madam Chair. So we're going to probably pass this along to Public Safety, and then hopefully your group will come together and come to Public Safety with your thoughts at that point, where we can maybe adjust it if needed, do an amendment if needed.
Mr. Cummings?
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, that is our hope. That's our sincere hope. I think hopefully by the end of today we'll be able to put the issues out on the table and then come forward with something that meets the needs of the whole group.
Very well. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure if it would be to Representative Smith or not, but when you do the contract for deed and you do the CRV at the time that you file the contract, my assumption is that when the contract is finally paid and that transfer is actually done, that the price reflected on the contract can't change from the time it was initially recorded, correct? So it would be much the same as maybe the same would happen with a mortgage when you're doing a contract for deed. You do the CRV once at the time of the real transaction. It's just that the transaction in this case isn't finalized until, indeed, the contract is satisfied.
Representative Smith or Mr. Dunleavy?
Madam Chair, Representative Ogilvie, you're exactly right. I mean, you have a contract, you make installment payments over time, and then when the deed is, when all the money is paid, then the deed is given. And the purchase price hasn't changed unless there's been an amendment to the contract for deed, and that would typically be recorded as well.
Any other questions? Representative Smith, is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? You know, Mr. Cummings, I believe, said that there was someone here from representing the county officers. I don't know if that person wants to come forward and just be on the record or not. Please come forward. Representative Dean, in the meantime, do you have a question?
Yeah, a quick question, Madam Chair, and thank you. Representative Smith, have appraisers groups come in and talked about this relative to how they do their work? Because it seems that having a five-year lag for them would somewhat be problematic in setting prices on other properties that are going up for sale around these.
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative, to my knowledge, they have not come forward with any concerns about this bill. The State Bar Association has been working on this issue for quite some time, so I think it's reasonable to say that they have knowledge of it and no concerns have been raised at this point. But if some do arise, Representative, we're more than happy to work with them, as we have with the prior testimony, testifier, to get this bill that's something that everyone can get behind and support.
Thank you. Please come forward, and I appreciate you coming down. And since you were mentioned, I thought it would be good if you came down and actually went on the record. So go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Amber Bougie, B-O-U-G-I-E, and I am the chair of the Minnesota County Recorders Association Legislative Committee. I'm also the chief deputy recorder for Hennepin County. And we've been discussing with the bar and their lobbyists, as well as Representative Smith, our concerns, and our hope is that we can come up with some amendments and present those before the public safety.
Thank you very much. Representative Smith, did you have any comments to add to that?
No, that is, Madam Chair, that is an accurate description of what's going on. Yes, we're working together.
All right, very good. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Any other questions from members? Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Smith renews his motion that House Bill 46 be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance. Did they drop Judiciary out of that title?
It hasn't been passed.
Oh, okay. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. House Bill 46 is on its way, and we look forward to hearing if there are any changes on that. Members, that concludes our agenda today. We will not be meeting next Tuesday. Because Monday is a holiday, we will not have floor session. Floor session is scheduled for 10 o'clock on Tuesday. So we will not be meeting next Tuesday. So enjoy your holiday weekend. And with that, we are adjourned.